Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast. The RTC features only the best OTR on our live stream, where we also invite you to tune in and enjoy the Radio Book Channel and the RTC Music Channel, all found at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. We're going to start off this week with The Life of Bliss, and this is from 1969. It's called The Export Man.
A Life of Bliss. Being a brand new biographical series about bachelor bliss with Brenda Bruce as Anne Fellows, Colin Gordon as her husband Tony Fellows, Muriel Pavlow as Tina Holliday, and George Cole as the shy young bachelor himself, David Alexander Bliss. Does Bliss find his basic shyness a disadvantage in everyday life? I spoke to him a couple of days ago and put the question to him.
Well, of course it's a disadvantage. Only a fool would deny it. So why haven't I?
Tell me, David, how would you describe your particular type of shyness?
Paralysis of the mind with a mouth working overtime.
But you don't let it worry you?
Well, life's a challenge. Obstacles made to be overcome.
You mean you still believe you'll overcome it one of these days?
I already have.
You have?
Yes. I forget which day it was. Well, I overcame it for a full 24 hours.
That long without getting into one of your muddles?
Yes, but to be fair, I think losing my voice helped.
Laryngitis?
About my only hope, to have it permanently.
Willpower doesn't work.
And the more I struggle to control myself, the tenser I become, the worse the mess I get into.
But you've known your girlfriend, Tina, quite a time.
No, look, I don't want to discuss my private life.
I know, but I take it that's an advantage.
Yes, and as I'm more relaxed with her and she puts up with me, you can take it, it's different.
Meaning what?
Well, I don't have to control myself with her because she never puts up a struggle. I never have to struggle because she doesn't mind being taken advantage of. Doesn't mind me messing her around. Doesn't mind me doing my worst. Doing her wrong. You see, it is a disadvantage.
Yes, I do see.
But, as I said before, life's a challenge. Tina made to be overcome. No.
And with that vintage model back to the present and over to the fellow's house to hear from David and his married sister Anne about the export man.
Know something, Anne? I am on the horns of a dilemma.
Then there's only one thing to do. Change chairs.
Do you want to hear about it or not?
If you eat your breakfast at the same time, it's getting cold.
Yes, okay. Somebody, I'd guess, somebody I...
Now, don't speak with your mouth full.
You don't seem to realize I am at a crossroads.
You do get around. Only a moment ago, you were on the...
Somebody, I'd guess, somebody I met during...
Psychic, go away.
You wouldn't be doing it on purpose.
No, it's this dog of yours. She's trying to hypnotize me into giving her some of my breakfast.
She never tries that on me at mealtimes. I've trained her not to.
You always give her titbits.
I know, that's how I trained her. Here you are, Psyche. Piece of sausage. Now, that's something she's never learned.
What?
Where titbits end and fingertips start.
What did all that mean?
What do I expect when the titbits are so small? Where was I?
Somebody, at a guess, somebody you met during...
During the 3 years I worked abroad, mm-hmm. has recommended me for a job with Marlowe and Ridgway Limited.
Marlowe and Ridgway?
Toy makers since 1897. Pioneered walkie-talkie dolls and now send them right round the world.
What, without rewinding?
They're forming a separate export department and want a bright, go-ahead young man to run it for them.
Who can you suggest?
I'd say I stood as good a chance as the next man.
Why, what's wrong with him?
The snag is, and I am ignoring you, that they're only offering a year's contract.
To start with, perhaps.
Yes, but I'm not only established in my present job, Anne. There's a pension at the end of it.
I know, and only about 40 years to go before you draw it.
You don't think security is important?
I'm not sure it even exists. Life's a gamble.
So you might just as well take risks.
Well, you do, every day, if you think about it. You could walk out of here now and be knocked down by a bus, pass a demolition site and be buried under falling debris, or even be struck by lightning.
That settles it. I'm not moving out of the house.
Risking the sack for not turning up at the office.
Okay, you've made your point, but... Well, part of the job would be entertaining overseas buyers.
So?
Well, it comes down to whether or not I've got away with people.
When it comes to people, you get away with murder.
You think I ought to try for it?
The chance of a lifetime. Ask Tony and see if he doesn't agree with me.
Well, I will when he comes down.
Do. It'll be a wonderful chance for him as well.
To do what?
Give you the full married man's lament, complete with sighs. David, old lad, he'll say, grab the chance while you can. While you're still, sigh, single. Once you're married, heavy sigh. You can't afford to take risks. You're the breadwinner.
Sigh.
Only my family prefers cake. A dig at me for wanting more housekeeping. You've got kids to clothe and endless, endless clothes to buy for your wife.
One last heartfelt heaving of the chest and end of lament.
You'll be lucky.
Well, there'll be more.
About all the golden opportunities he's had to miss through being married.
Well, has he missed all that minute?
A man we met at a party did offer him a partnership in some big scheme guaranteed to make a cool quarter of a million.
And Tony turned it down because he had to play safe?
No, because he hadn't got the man's name, address, or phone number and never heard from him again. Apart from that, it was definite.
Oh, now, look, you're not trying to tell me they've all been like that.
All myths, all based on a germ of truth.
Oh, not complete myths, then. Not if they were based
near
on...
Near enough, believe me. But then there's something of a Walter Mitty in every man.
Dreaming of fame and fortune?
Yes, and making marriage the excuse for them not coming through.
Oh, but Tony has done jolly well.
I know. That's what I'm always telling him.
Morning, Dave. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, fine, thanks, Walter. You? fine, thanks, Tony. I'm sorry about that. We were just talking about Tony Mitty. Tony Tycoon.
Walter Mitty.
Walter Mitty.
I was about to say I'm sorry I'm laid down, but perhaps it's just as well. And good morning to you, too.
I'll pour out your coffee first, darling.
Anything in the paper this morning?
Yes, the bills from the paper shop.
That's what I call starting the day right.
Where? Stapled to the middle page.
Yeah. Symbolic once you're married.
Huh?
Bills are your staple diet.
I say, ahead of schedule.
What?
The lament.
Lament?
Lamentable fact is that the cost of living has gone up.
What prompted that?
David's not his usual self this morning.
He has been so far.
He's got the chance of a wonderful new export job with...
Marlowe and Ridgway Limited, makers of Midge toys. Only, well, in a way, I'd be on 12 months trial.
Then they want their money back.
No, seriously, though, Tony, what would you do if you were me?
Yeah, I won't depress you by saying what, but I'd have done it years ago. How about my breakfast?
On my way now. Talk some sense into him, darling. He's not sure it's worth the risk because they're only offering a year's contract.
Not worth the risk? My dear old lad, you must be out of your tiny mind.
Well, was that ever in doubt?
Well, certainly not the size. What's the next move?
We'll ring up and arrange an interview with Mr. Marlowe.
Then phone today.
Well, let the future take care of itself.
Why not? You don't have to worry about the future. Not yet, that is. Of course, once you're married, you're...
Oh, there it is.
What?
The first heartfelt heaving of the chest. Understandably. After all, it is...
What's Anne been saying about me?
What makes you think she said anything?
Long experience of deciphering your slips of the tongue.
Yes, well, you slipped up this time and interrupted me.
She hasn't said anything about me at all?
No, not a word. Well, as I was lying, Tony... as I was sighing, saying...
You were right the first time.
It is different when you're married. After all, you can't afford to take risks then, can you?
No, indeed.
You've got responsibilities.
You're the breadwinner.
Only your family prefers cake.
Yeah, my family. Now, how did you know about that?
I didn't know.
Know what?
That you'd made the same joke to Anne.
Did I say I had?
No.
Then how do you know that's what I meant?
You wouldn't accept telepathy as an answer. No, I thought not. Well, I somehow gave the impression...
Oh, say, David, what do you take me for? It's quite plain Anne's been drearing on about me as usual, and I know exactly what she's been saying.
Well, I'm not surprised. I've told you most of it.
Ah, so you admit it was her?
Yes, it was all light-hearted. I mean, Anne doesn't drear on behind your back, Tony. You ought to know that.
No, I do, oddly enough. More coffee?
Yeah, I think perhaps I will. Thanks, Tony.
Well, pour your own and one for me, two lumps.
Yes, righto.
Heaven knows, I don't regret getting married, but... right, can't take the same risks. I missed a good few opportunities myself.
I know, so Anne was telling me. In passing.
What was she telling you?
About all the golden opportunities you've had to miss. Had to miss. It was two lumps, wasn't it?
And how do you explain that clip?
What flip?
That flip? What flip?
Oh, the misslip flip. The misslip. Well, I honestly can't say.
Can't say. I know why you can't say, because Anne's told you I've never had any worthwhile offers. They're all complete myths, or put it another way, a pack of lies.
Oh, no, that's not true, Tony. She never mentioned the word pack. The word complete.
You've been living with us ever since you got back from abroad, haven't you?
Well, yes.
Seems to me there's a connection between the country's economic situation and my marriage to Anne.
There is?
We may have to export you to survive.
Here you are, darling. Bacon, two eggs, and three sausages. Bacon, two eggs, and two sausages. You're a bad dog.
You know, Sonny Anne, breakfasts like this make up for all the golden opportunities I've missed.
Do they?
Yes, and what's more, it's a great comfort to know that in my wife's eyes I can do no wrong.
David?
Don't worry, he didn't make a single flip.
Oh, that's all right then. single slip.
I'll ring up Mr. Marlowe's secretary and fix up the interview the moment I get to the office. I've decided.
Good for you.
Terribly sudden, though.
Yes, I wonder why.
David, didn't you say your general manager was calling in on you this morning?
Between 9:30 and 10.
Of course, it's not Mr. Hood now, is it?
No, a chap called Gibson.
How are you getting on with him?
Not at all well. And he doesn't even know me yet.
Well, you don't see all that much of him, do you?
Well, hardly at all. Luckily, he's got 5 other branch offices to look after, apart from...
Between 9:30 and 10?
Yes, so I'll have to be there prompt at 9:30.
It's 9:25 now.
Well, I know, but it only takes me 20 minutes. 9:25 now? Good gracious, so it is. Oh, well, at least I can stop worrying about the security of this job and about my pension.
Why?
Well, chances are I'll get the push. David Bliss?
Anne, were you in trouble?
What, for being late? No, old Gibson hasn't turned up yet.
Have you phoned?
Mr. Marlowe's secretary about the interview. Yes, I have, and I'm seeing him at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
I'm sure you'll get the job.
I'd like to think so.
I know you will. But, David, I shouldn't say anything to Mr. Gibson until you've actually got it. After all, you never know.
Well, you just said you did know.
I know, but I could easily be wrong. You'd better make some excuse for not being there tomorrow morning, you know, just in case.
Yes, but what can I tell him?
Anything. Except that your grandmother's died. That one's been done to death. And how about the dentist's appointment? That's a reliable old standby.
Well, it's not a question of the excuse being reliable, Anne. It's me I'm worried about.
What's he like?
Gibson?
Yes.
Well, pally enough on the surface. Puffed up with his own importance underneath.
A snake by any other name.
Definitely venomous.
Morning, Miss Latimer. This in?
I'll have to hang up, Anne. He's just slithered in.
Good luck.
Goodbye.
Hello there, Blitz.
Hello there, pal. Poison. Sorry about that. I was thinking of something my sister said on the phone.
Private calls during office hours. I don't think we can stand for that, you know.
I'll pull up a chair for you, sir.
No, not stopping. Just dropped in with the Williamson file. Won't have a natter about it, but I'm pushed for time today. Next time, I'm in.
When will that be, sir?
Tomorrow morning.
I had a feeling. About what time?
Shall we say 10 o'clock?
Oh, no, let's not. I'm afraid I won't be here, sir.
All right, taking the day off?
No, I've got an appointment with my grandmother. My grandmother's dentist.
What the heck's your grandmother got to do with it?
We always talk about him as being her dentist.
Oh, why?
Oh, she was going to him long after she was dead. Long before we did. Actually, everybody I know goes to him.
A good man, is he?
Oh, yes, a very reliable old standby. Good old chap. Everybody stands by him. Swears by him.
What the heck's the matter with you this morning?
Nervous about tomorrow morning, sir. If there's one thing in the world I hate, it's interviews. With the dentist.
Well, I'll be here at 11:30. And you better be back by then, or I might suspect the dentist is an excuse. I'm like that, you know. Well, I'll see you then. What's his name?
The dentist, sir? Oh, Mr. Forbes. Oh,
I haven't bothered since I moved down here. It was high time I had a checkup. Jot down his phone number for me.
Oh, yes. Righto, sir.
If he's really that good.
Well, the best dentist for miles around.
I'll ring him today and mention your name.
You're the second best for miles around. There's somebody even better. In fact, there's no comparison.
No?
Well, everybody I know is changing to him.
But a minute ago you said everybody you knew went to your bloke.
Well, that just shows how quickly they're changing. I mean, that is, I have heard the most glowing reports about this other bloke.
I should think he's booked up for months ahead, then.
Well, bound to be.
In that case, I'll settle for the second best. You're Mr. Forbes. 994-3592. Thanks for recommending him.
Don't mention it, sir. Well, I wish I hadn't. Taken up so much of your time.
I had an interesting letter from head office the other day.
You did?
Asking me to submit recommendations for reducing the number of branch offices in this area. In other words, heads are going to roll. Ha, ha, ha. Goodbye, Bliss.
Chop, chop, sir. I start the day talking about my pension and end up under the guillotine.
I doubt if he'll check up on you, even if he does ring the dentist.
Well, that's what Tony said when I told him about it.
I'm sure we're right. What's this?
A copy of the Toy Manufacturer's Trade Journal with an article about Marlowe and Ridgway in it. I've marked the page.
With pencil?
No, sweaty thumbprints.
You worried about the interview?
Well, it's bound to be more important to me now.
Right, I'm ready. What time are they expecting us?
7:30.
I'll ask Clive Howard if he knows anything about Marlowe, David. It'd be helpful to know what sort of man you're facing tomorrow.
I'll need all the help I can get.
On the contrary, I'd say you've got everything to look forward to. Money to spend and a chance to travel.
Well, meaning what? Occasional business trips abroad?
No, regular trips between here and the Labour Exchange.
He's in the state now without you making him worse.
Isn't Tina coming around?
Well, any minute now. Why?
Gaze into her eyes. Tell her you love her and you'll soon forget about tomorrow.
Well, there's something in that.
I suppose you have told her you love her.
Well, no, not in so many words.
It only takes 3.
Well, I want to be absolutely sure first.
You told me you were weeks ago now.
Well, I think I am.
Well, then take a risk on it and tell her, sir.
Well, we're back to life's a gamble, eh?
Well, you never get anywhere unless you do tell her.
That's the story of David's life.
What?
More stalemate than cellmate.
Well, it hasn't reached the marrying stage yet.
Nah, that's the biggest gamble of all.
You don't have to tell me that. I lost. Heavily. I'm just going to put my coat on and switch Alexander's light off. What? No, Psyche, you stay in there.
Does Tina know about the Exmoor job?
Yes, I rang her this afternoon.
What'd she say?
That she was sure I got a wonderful future ahead of me and couldn't be more pleased.
Naturally. She's hoping to share it with you.
Well, I'm certain the thought of marriage has never entered Tina's head.
Oh, my dear chap, it's been there since she was 12.
But whether or not I was successful definitely wouldn't enter it.
Don't you believe it. Women, very practical. They pay lip service to the idea of love in a garret, then arrange for you to meet Father.
Well, and the connection?
First thing he asks is, what are your prospects?
Well, Tina's got prospects of her own. Working on a magazine must pay well, too. So there you are.
Well,
that'll be her now.
All right, I'll go.
I believe I do love her, you know. What's more, I've had a terrific urge to tell her so.
Then why the dickens haven't you?
Well, because of the risk involved, I suppose. The risk of being rebuffed.
Yes. Oh, I can't believe there's the slightest reason for you to worry about that.
Well, that's very reassuring.
After all, you've had so much experience, haven't you?
Well, there's only one way to find out.
Yes, but David, not the moment she arrives. You can't tell a girl you love her in cold blood. They take it very seriously.
Well, so do I.
Well, make sure you do a good warm-up.
Honestly, I don't really think you were talking about a comedy show.
Knowing you, I probably am. All the world's a stage and all women love pretty speeches.
Well, they're my downfall.
Well, there you are. That's show business. Lead up to it slowly. Work up a nice romantic atmosphere.
Oh, well, I've got nothing to lose by trying.
And everything to gain.
So, all right, I'll have a bash at it.
Here you go, Tina. Hello.
Oh, hello. Hello, darling.
Hello, Psyche. Would you forgive us if we dashed off straight away?
They'd never forgive us if we didn't.
Bye. Goodbye.
Bad news, honey. I can't stay long.
Oh, no.
My editor sprang an interview on me at the last moment. Gerald Booth, the author.
Well, how long can you stay?
Oh, say, half an hour.
Oh, that's all right. We've still got time if we get down to it straight away.
Get down to what?
Well, I'm afraid I can't tell you yet.
Why not?
Well, I've got to get you warmed up first. Here, I'll help you off with your coat.
Warmed up?
Get you into the mood for it.
If I didn't know you so well, I'd suspect the worst. How about giving me a clue?
A clue?
Yes.
Well, it's something I've got a terrific urge to do.
Perhaps I don't know you as well as I thought.
You will by the time I finish.
Is it something serious?
Well, girls take it seriously, yes. And so do I. I mean, after all, it does involve a certain risk.
A risk?
Well, obviously.
You've just got to be talking about... No. No, you can't have changed that much.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know we're wasting time. Come and sit on the sofa.
You've got me worried.
Well, why should you worry? You've got nothing to lose.
I don't like the sound of that.
You'll like it all right once I get going.
The suspense is terrible.
Oh, there you are. That's show business. Come what may, I'm determined to have a bash.
I should have listened to Mother.
Why, what did she say?
Never mind what she said. What are you trying to say?
That I love you.
Oh, so that's what it was all about. Oh, I'm sorry to laugh, honey, only it sounded as if you meant something very different.
Why, what did I say?
Oh, for instance, that it was something you had a terrific urge to do.
Well, I can't see what possible double meaning that could... Oh, yes, I can. You didn't seriously imagine that I... Good heavens, it never crossed my mind. Well, it never would.
I know it wouldn't, really.
Actually, that's not strictly true. I mean, well, sitting beside you, close beside you, I'm not entirely unaware that... That is, I mean... Well, you know, I do. Not that I would, of course, but it does.
I'd be livid if it didn't.
I do love you, Tina, with all my heart. Yes. Yes, that's how I love you. With all my heart. I love you. Do you?
No. No, please don't ask me.
Then you don't?
Oh, it isn't that, darling. It's just that...
Just what?
That I don't want to say it until I'm absolutely sure.
Oh, go on. Take a risk on it. I did.
You're not sure either?
Yes, I am. Completely sure, I think.
Yes. Well, I won't say it now. The moment's passed. Next time round, perhaps. Are you feeling more relaxed about tomorrow?
Tomorrow? Oh, about the interview, you mean. Oh, I wish you hadn't reminded me.
Now, don't start that again. You've got a wonderful future ahead of you, and, oh, I couldn't be more pleased.
Well, naturally. You're hoping to share it with me.
I've just told you. I'm not sure yet.
I know, but you women are very practical.
Are you suggesting that would make any difference?
Well, are you saying you'd spend the rest of your life in a garret?
If I had to, yes.
Enter your father.
My father?
And what young man are your prospects?
I'd better go before I blow my top.
Oh, come on, I was only joking.
If I was interested in money, I'd marry somebody like Gerald Booth. He's stinking rich.
Well, I see, so that's why you're rushing off in such a hurry.
I won't count up to 10. It wouldn't be enough. Goodbye.
Oh, no, look, Tina, we can't leave it like this.
There isn't time to sort it out now. Besides, it just isn't our night. Night, darling. Don't bother to show me out. I'll give you a ring when I get back to the flat. Bye.
I couldn't agree more. If I'd known how things were going to turn out when I walked out of here this morning, I'd have settled for being knocked down by a bus.
David!
Just coming.
It's a big day for your master, isn't it, Psyche?
I was on the phone in the other room.
Couldn't you use the phone in here?
Not at the same time, no.
You can be late for your interview.
Apparently, Tina's in the bath.
Let's see how you look.
According to her flatmate, Sheila, that is.
Yes, very smart.
I don't call it smart, I call it a barefaced lie. All right, so I said some pretty tactless things last night, but there's no excuse for her refusing to speak to me.
Oh, don't be silly. She'll ring back as soon as she gets out of the bath.
She promised to ring last night.
You know, I don't think that tie goes with that suit. Oh, and David, you can't wear those socks. Sit down and have your breakfast, and I'll...
Morning, dear Nellie.
Morning.
A bag in a second, darling.
I know. Stroke of luck, old Clive Howard, knowing Marlowe personally, wasn't it? David?
Yes, it was.
Apparently Marlowe's highly intelligent, but essentially human. Now, that gives us a slant on the interview.
It does?
An uneven match, but you could win on sympathy. He's also got a complete bee in his bonnet about the export or die bit. He even talks about the country living in the past and of...
The need for us to think of ourselves not as a nation of shopkeepers, but as super salesmen in the markets of the world. The urgent need to adopt modern methods and to seek fresh techniques.
How on earth did you know?
From the article in the Trade Journal. It quotes from some speech he made.
Well, there you are, then. You're laughing, aren't you?
Well, of course I am. What at?
The thought of running their export department. And the best way of landing the job is to convince Marlowe you're just as keen as he is.
In other words, that I've got a bee in my bonnet.
Yes, and in your case, that should come naturally. Now, that's the way to handle the interview. Base it on that speech of his, without, of course, using his exact words.
Well, you really think I'd be that stupid?
Don't force me. Now, mind you, David... You will have to make it sound more...
Here you are, David. Another pair of socks.
I have to make it sound more conversational.
I picked out this tie for you.
Less flowery, in fact.
I don't know about flowery.
I was talking Tony.
Yeah, a bit less, yes.
It does go better with your socks.
On the other hand...
So do these socks.
As he obviously enjoys a flowery phrase himself...
I put them beside you, look.
It might be an idea to...
Think up one or two of my own, really.
Yes. Then produce them like rabbits out of a hat. For example, let me think.
Well, shouldn't I be the one thinking?
Children are the same the world over, and I won't be content till each and every one of them is playing with Midge toys.
I say, that's rather good, isn't it, David?
Yes, it's a pity Tony can't go to the interview for me.
I know, but that would make for awful complications afterwards. Eat your breakfast.
Now, don't forget, David, bees in your bonnet keenness.
Yes, and David, another thing.
Oh, now, look, enough. I know you both mean well, but this is something I've got to do on my own. On my own, understand? I'll think up my own phrases. And I'll stick to the tie I'm wearing. And I couldn't change into these socks because I've just spread them with butter and marmalade. I've had enough advice, thank you. All I want now is a little peace and quiet. Is that quite clear? What was one thing and... Oh, thank goodness, that'll be Tina now. Hello?
Gibson here.
Oh, good morning, sweetheart. Hello, good morning, sir.
I rang your dentist yesterday. But strange as it may seem, he's not expecting you this morning.
Yes, well, I can explain that.
At your office at 9:30 sharp.
But I won't be there.
And if you're not, there's no point in turning up at all.
But you don't understand, sir. I've got an appointment for an important... Hello? Mr. Gibson? Sir? Oh, dear. That was sir to say that...
I know. We heard.
Whatever are you going to do, David?
Life's a gamble. But what odds? Sit down, Mr. Blitz.
Thank you, Miss Marlowe. Sorry to have kept you waiting.
Oh, that's all right, sir. I was quite happy toying with your secretary. Not that you have kept me waiting long.
Is toying the word you wanted?
I beg your pardon, sir?
Is toying the word you wanted?
I can't think of any particular use for it at the moment.
You used it in connection with my secretary.
Oh, good gracious, did I? Well, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Marlowe. I meant I was talking to the doll. Talking to the girl.
Well, you know what all this is about.
Yes, sir. And let me say straight away that I couldn't be keener to run the bee department. To run the export hive. That a department. But then I've got a definite bee in my bonnet about the whole export situation. It seems to me, sir, that this country's bedded down in the past.
I couldn't agree more.
It's time we woke up, too, and thought of ourselves as, well, world salesmen.
I've said so myself before now. Not in those exact words, of course.
Well, of course not. I'm not that stupid. You were stupid enough to think I could put it as well as you, sir.
I'd say you put it very well. Care for a cup of coffee?
Oh, no, thank you. Your secretary gave me one while I was waiting.
Sounds as if she's taken quite a fancy to you.
Well, I wouldn't know about that, sir, but I really do feel it very strongly.
What?
That it's vital for each and every one of us to find new ways to deflower our secretaries.
Deflower them?
To seek new techniques when we're bedded down with them. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Sex on the brain by the sound of it.
It certainly isn't that, sir.
Nerves, then.
Yes, sir. But even so, confident that you can increase your overseas sex. Under the sale of your products overseas. And for an obvious reason.
Which is?
Women are the same the world over, and I won't be satisfied till I've got them all producing like rabbits.
Interviews are always nerve-wracking affairs. I suggest you try to be yourself.
I have been myself. There stands to reason I'm not the right man for the job, so I'll save you the embarrassment and say it for you.
Say what, for goodness sake?
There are other applicants to be seen, Mr. Bliss, but you'll be hearing from us in due course. As a matter of interest, where is the labor exchange?
You can't be sure. You haven't got the job yet.
Well, I can be pretty sure, considering I told him I wasn't right for it.
But he still went on with the interview, didn't he?
Well, only out of politeness or sadism. But I can be certain about my present job. Gibson's given me a month's notice.
Oh, dear.
Still, there's one thing about it. It's just as well.
No, okay, I'll answer.
Just as well Tina's disappeared out of my life.
Yeah?
I couldn't afford a girlfriend now that I'm out of...
David, it's for you. And I think you're in for a surprise.
You don't mean it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's marvellous. Hello, darling.
Marlowe here.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, sweetheart. I didn't realize.
I thought I'd ring you and tell you I've decided to take a risk and give you the job. Not that I consider it all that much of a gamble. Not after this morning.
Well, how do you mean, sir?
I can't believe you could ever be worse. I'll be in touch. Bye.
Bye, Mr. Marlowe. Thanks for ringing. I've got the job.
Oh, congratulations, wonderful,
oh, that'll be Mrs. Leggett. I'll go.
Funny, but now that I know it's all right, it feels flat somehow.
Probably because you're not used to the idea yet.
No, it isn't that, Tony. It's, well,
Tina, eh?
Tina.
Mm. What about me?
Yeah.
Did ring you this morning, darling, just after you'd left. Only Anne forgot to tell you.
Tony, would you come and give me a hand in the kitchen?
Oh, funny you should say that. I was going to ask you to give me a hand in the garage.
You've got the job, then.
Yes, but what's more important, I've got you. I do love you, Tina.
I love you.
Oh, good gracious. So you've decided to take a risk on it after all?
Yes. So where do we go from here? Meet father, wedding bells, and up the aisle?
Ah, no. Life may be a gamble, but you've got to stick to the rules.
Meaning what?
Let's stop while we're winning.
That was The Life of Bliss, with George Cole as David Bliss, Brenda Bruce as Anne Fellows, Colin Gordon as Tony Fellows, Muriel Pavlo as Tina Holliday, and Percy Edwards as Psyche. Gibson was played by Frederick Treves and Marlowe by Lockwood West. The Life of Bliss is written by Godfrey Harrison and produced by Edward Taylor.
We had a comment from one of our listeners on one of our other endeavors, the Book Channel, and she was commenting that she loved the English programs that we brought back on the Book Channel. It reminds her of her youth, so we're glad to bring them to her via podcast as well. Back in 1941, they had a program called Behind the Mic. They called it Radio's Own Show, and the reason for that is because they talked about radio and radio business and what went on behind the scenes. This time, we're going to listen in on how comedy broadcasts are made.
Radio's Own Show, Behind the Mic. Radio. radio. With a switch of your dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But there are stories behind radio. Yes, stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and as interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you, the human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now presenting a man whose name has been a symbol of the best in radio since the beginning of broadcasting, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gilbert Martin, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. This afternoon, Behind the Mic shows you how a radio comedy broadcast is written. We bring you the sound effect of the week, a dramatization of an amusing little incident involving orchestra leader B.A. Rolfe. How a singing trio is being groomed for radio success by NBC. A salute to one of radio's favorite old programs, Whittall's Anglo-Persians, featuring the music of Louis Katzman. And finally, a dramatic story behind a broadcast by Tom Powers, well-known star of radio and stage. For those of you who wonder how your favorite comedian puts together a program, we're going to show you how this is sometimes done. And if you think it's easy, Gandhi is India's best-dressed man. And now, writing on a comedy program very often starts 2 weeks before the broadcast, as most comedians like to keep at least a week ahead of their scripts. Nowadays, a comedian may have, say, two main writers or more, and a number of subordinate writers. Let's say we attend the meeting of a comedian whom we'll call Eddie McGee, and his two main writers, Jack Pun and Joe Gag, at Eddie's home, where they're getting their first program ideas.
All right, fellas, now what'll we do for our opening routine?
Well, how about some jokes about you going to the racetrack and losing your shirt?
No, I think that's been overdone. Comedians have lost their shirts so much, laundrymen are picketing the bookies.
I think he's right, Jack.
But look, I've got some good gags for it. Good how the gags. Racetrack had a beautiful infield, and after the third race, you had it for lunch. Oh, another guy picks your pocket and takes your wallet and the list of the races you were betting on. Then the guy takes one look at the list, and he hands back your wallet with an extra dime for car fare.
Very funny.
Don't like it?
Didn't Bob Hope do something like that?
Well, so what? We'll twist him.
And what twist have you got?
Well, instead of eating the infield after the third race, you eat it after the fifth.
Oh, fine.
I don't like the jokes anyway for Eddie's program, Jack. Even your wife wouldn't laugh at him.
What do you mean, wife? I'm married to my jokes.
It'll never be a successful marriage.
Why not?
Your wife's older than you are. Oh.
Hey, that's not bad. That's not bad. We can use that in the script.
Hey, boys, we're forgetting something.
What is it, Joe?
That's going to be the Washington's birthday program. We've got to have the first routine on George Washington.
Oh.
How you never tell a lie and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right, Joe. Now, for our second routine, we'd better carry on the feud between Phil and me about the money I say I lent him.
Mm-hmm.
He still refuses to pay me back.
Yeah, we could carry that on for two spots.
Well, how about the last spot, fellas? We need a good sketch.
It's getting around income tax day.
And that's a goodie, an income sketch.
Yeah, if you can say it.
Yeah. Well, listen, suppose you fellas start thinking about that. I think we ought to...
There may be several other fellas, or perhaps enough of them to give us adequate national defense, working on the show, but their function is generally to submit jokes on subjects that the main writers and the comedians have selected. 2 or 3 days later, the main writers and the comedian get together again. Everything's been written except the sketch.
Here it is, Eddie, here it is. Look. Joe and I have been talking this thing over, and we got a sketch that works out like this. Listen now. You come into the income tax office.
Yeah.
You've been looking through your income tax, and you find out that you didn't pay the government enough for 1938. You owe them $5.42. Well, now, being an honest guy, you want to pay the income tax department this back tax, which they ain't discovered that you haven't paid.
The income tax collector doesn't believe you.
Yeah, naturally. Well, that's good. Go on.
Okay. He says that probably the real reason you want to pay your back tax is that you're a crook. And that it's your way to ease your conscience.
Oh, say, I like that. There's always comedy and menace.
Well, it gets you sympathy.
Yeah.
That's what makes Jack Benny.
He thinks you're a criminal, so he calls the police station. In the next scene, you're in the police station being third degreed. The police are trying to find out what crime you committed.
And you keep saying that all you want to do is pay your $5.42 back income tax. We throw in a lot of gags back and forth.
Then the cops decide you're nuts. It isn't a case for them. It's a case for the psychopathic ward.
So in the next scene, you're in the psychopathic ward. You've been there a month.
A psychoanalyst comes in, and he starts to psychoanalyze you.
And after you psychoanalyze, the guy from the income tax department comes back, and he says that they studied your case, and they decided to let you go.
Yeah, but that's no punch finish.
Yeah, but that ain't the finish.
Oh,
listen,
go ahead.
You go back to the income tax department, and the income tax collector isn't there, see?
He's out.
He's on a vacation.
Yeah.
There's a new man taking his place. You tell him that you're there to pay $5.42 back income tax. He starts giving you the same business as the first guy. He's just about to accuse you of being a criminal.
When you say, I'll save you the trouble, you grab the phone yourself and say, hello, give me police headquarters.
Hey, that sounds like the nuts. And I just thought of a great gag for the Psycho LaLancia scene.
Yeah, if you can say it.
Yeah, well, anyway, the doctor says to me...
Well, after the writers whip the sketch together, the comedian usually goes over it himself and makes changes and, working with his writers, gags it up or cuts it. And now some, although not all comics, have previews of radio programs. That is, about a week before the broadcast, they try out their script in a live studio audience invited especially for that purpose. After the tryout, the main writers and the comedian get together at the comedian's home once more.
Say, did you fellas mark down the gags that laid eggs? I laid so many, I feel like front man for a hen.
Oh, go on.
Oh, no, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. If those weakies go out, it'll tighten the script. Then we'll get better laughs on the other gags.
And so the script is cut and strengthened. Meanwhile, the boys have started work on the following week's script. Then comes the broadcast, when the script, which the writers and the comedian have written, will stand or fall. And that, ladies and gentlemen, shows you how easily the spontaneous script you hear on the air is often ad-libbed. The sound effect of the week. From time to time, Behind the Mic presents some sound effect which was used on a program of the past week and tells exactly how it was done. On the program Manhattan at Midnight, the sound effect of a toboggan sled going down a slide was used. It sounded like this. This effect was made, believe it or not, by taking an ordinary pie plate with a hole in the center and spreading it with cornstarch and salt. And then it was placed on a phonograph turntable, and using a needle with a flat end, the pie plate was actually played on the phonograph like a record. A toboggan sled going down a slide. Ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon we're going to take you behind the scenes to show you what happens when NBC decides to build an act and attempt to promote it towards radio success. As a current example, we're going to use a trio called the Singing Powers Models. I want to introduce you to the man who had the idea of forming this group and who is generally responsible for building them up, an executive of NBC's Program and Talent Department, Mr. Ruby Cowan. Hiya, Ruby.
Graham, how are you?
Ruby, exactly who are these girls that NBC decided to try to promote towards radio success?
Well, Graham, they're three gorgeous Powers models.
I can see that.
Girls who pose for advertisements in the big magazines. And they are Lulus.
You're not kidding. You're not kidding. If they were only flowers and I were a bee. Oh, boy.
Well, I tell you, the name of John Powers' model has great advertising value. Mm. So we figured that if we could get three of his girls who could sing, and sing well, then they had a chance of clicking. After conferring with Mr. Powers and auditioning 30 of his models, we selected the trio. By we, I mean myself and Bob Kerr, who was to be their personal representative when we sent them out into the theaters.
Couldn't you have rung me in there somewhere, Ruby?
It's too late now, Graham.
Too bad.
The next step was to get a vocal coach, and we decided to select a girl who herself had sung in a trio, Miss Joan Brooks. Joan had been one of the Three Little Words in Phil Spitalny's group, and she'd also been responsible for much of the success of the Four Bells. We hired a crackerjack songwriter, Jay Levison, to write and arrange special material for the trio. He and Joan Brooks got together, and she told him what type of music the girls should have.
Look, Jay, these kids have never worked together as a trio before, and I don't think we ought to give them anything too difficult to start off with.
All right, Joan, what do you want?
Well, they have fresh, sweet voices.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should have fresh, sweet tunes and novelty numbers.
Yeah.
I'd make trio arrangements of melodies like Song of the Islands, and you write whatever novelty numbers you want to.
Okay, I'll get to work right away.
After the numbers are written, Jay and Joan rehearse the girls at Joan's apartment.
Oh, wait a minute, girls. Stop just a minute. Listen, Carolyn, you're singing a little too loudly.
Oh, I'm sorry, John.
Here's a good thing to remember. Next time any one of you girls can't hear the other two girls, then you're singing too loudly. Now let's take it again.
Hawaiian
Now we figure that we're having the trio work together before an audience would be the best way of seasoning them so they could eventually be presented to a radio sponsor, as well as having them pick up some money.
Oh, now, Ruby, you're just getting commercial.
Well, anyway, Graham, we booked them in out-of-town theaters. In order to get the publicity for them, their personal representative, Bob Kerr, goes into those towns a week before their appearance so that he might make an appointment to see the head of the fashion shops and department stores.
Now, look here. How about having a little fashion show at your store sometime next week when the girls will be in town and use them as models? You can advertise the fashion show and mention that the girls are appearing at the theater. You'll get them as models, and we'll get a plug for their personal appearance.
Well, I think that's a great idea. I'll be glad to, Mr. Carr.
Due to their ability to sing, their beauty, and the publicity they get, they break records in several of the cities in which they appear. And when an act does that, it stands to reason it will be good for a radio sponsor. And that's what we're building them up for, sponsorship.
Well, where'll they be next week, Ruby?
Well, next week they start Friday at the State Theater in Hartford, Connecticut, with Cleveland and Dayton to follow.
Uh-huh. Well, how about getting some radio publicity for them?
Well, we've got them on this program behind the mic, haven't we? And I think that's a good start.
Yes, that's true, Ruby. Well, girls, suppose you show our listeners the type of singing that we hope you'll be doing regularly on the air someday for some nice, big, juicy commercial sponsor.
Merry goes round on the merry-go-round as the music plays. She gaily shouts as she goes round the mound on her holiday. Cymbals ring and zing as she takes a swing and grabs at the ring while Iopes play the day away. Each hour is one sweet song, and merry, merry goes round on her merry-go-round as the ponies glide. Merry, merry, they ride and ride. What a treat to feel the beat of a thumping drum, boom, ta-rum, as Mary goes up and down and round and round and round on her merry-go-round.
Oh, I love to hear the calliopes play, boom, 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 boom. But I'd rather swing every night and day, do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
But this is a waltz.
You can swing a waltz. You'll just have to bloop, bloop, and do as we say. A one, a two, a three. Heck.
Mary goes round on her merry-go-round as the music plays. She gaily shouts as she goes round the bar on her holiday. Cymbals ring and zing as she takes the swing and grabs at the ring. Calliopes play the day away. Each hour is one sweet song, and merry, merry goes round on her merry-go-round while the ponies glide. Even the grown-ups don't want to be shown up. They ride and ride. What a treat to feel the beat of a thumping drum, boom, ta-rum, as Mary goes up and down and round and round and round on her merry-go-round.
Thank you, girls, thank you. And boy, oh boy, if you people only knew what you're missing, because you ain't got no television sets. It practically got me in tears. Oddities in Radio. presenting odd little true behind-the-mic stories that help make radio sometimes amusing, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting to the people in it. This week's oddity. And here's one of radio's veteran band leaders and one of the grandest guys in the business, B.A. Rolfe, to tell you an experience of his when he had the Lucky Strike program back in 1928. B.A. Rolfe, a shadow of his former self. B.A., that was some band you had back in those days.
Yes, Graham, we had the loudest band that ever hit the airwaves.
Yep.
It was a perfect musical shooting gallery.
Well, what was the story, V.A.?
Well, Graham, one day we were rehearsing in a studio. It was up at 711 Fifth Avenue before the NBC moved to its present palatial quarters. And Dr. Walter Damrosch was NBC's very highly respected and somewhat feared musical director. He had heard about our band, and one day he paid a visit to the studio. He sat in the control room and listened while we blasted away rehearsing. All right, boys, take 5 minutes.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Rolfe.
Oh, hello, Dr. Damrosch. How do you like the band?
Mr. Rolfe, let me ask you one question. Do you broadcast on a network?
Yes, Dr. Damrosch. We are heard coast to coast through 46 stations.
Mm. What a waste of money. Huh? Why don't you just open the window?
Thank you, V.A. Rolfe. Thank you very much. Behind the Mic salutes a program you loved. We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud. A tradition of good programs that linger fondly in our memory. And so each week, we bring you a star or a part of a program you used to hear. A program you love. This afternoon, we salute Whittall's Anglo-Persians, which was on the air from 1926 to 1930, and which featured the music of Louis Katzman and his orchestra. Whittall's Anglo-Persians.
I am the voice of the crystal ball of fate. I lift mine eyes unto the crystal ball, and lo, I see a city of ancient Araby. And mine eyes are amazed to view flying over the city, even as I have read of it in the Arabian Nights, a magic carpet on which is sitting a turbaned prince. The magic carpet fades into the hazy.
Thank you.
I look into the crystal ball of fate once more, and lo, the magic carpet has returned from its journey to distant lands. It descends to the palace roof of its princely rider. The crystal ball clouds and then darkens. I see all.
Thank you, Louis Katzman, for helping us recreate a small part of that happy program. It takes me back 16 years. Tom Powers, no relation to John Powers, the model impresario, is undoubtedly one of the most proficient actors of the stage and radio. He's also one of the most delightful raconteurs to whom I've ever had the pleasure of listening. Tom's present program is called That's Not New York, in which he tells true stories about America's largest city. Presenting Tom Powers.
Well, Graham, this story is about a former program of mine called Life Studies, in which I used to tell unusual stories about real people. I offered a certain amount of money for every true story I could use on the air. One day, a man came into my office and told me he was an international jewel thief who had just gotten out of prison after serving a long stretch. His cellmate, Bill, a much younger man, when he was only 18 years old, had killed a policeman. As the jewel thief told it to me, during the boy's trial, things were going pretty much against him, and it looked as if he might wind up in the chair. Then the boy's mother was called as a witness, and as she walked by him toward the stand...
Willie. Oh, Willie.
Listen, Ma. I don't want you to say nothing. Just keep your mouth shut, and I'll beat this rap. Don't you say nothing. If you do, I'll never talk to you again.
This way, please. You do solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Willie, he's a good boy at heart. He just got in with a lot of bad companions. I think it's my fault, too, Your Honor. I've had to make a living for us both. I just couldn't give him the time a growing boy should have. If I could have been with him more, I could have shown him what was right. Oh, please, Your Honor. Please, you give him a chance, eh? I'm sure that if he...
And therefore, I sentence you to spend the rest of your natural life in the state penitentiary.
Come to see you as soon as they let me.
Don't you ever come near me. You and your preaching, 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 that's all you ever done. I don't ever want to see you again.
All right, Bill. Come along.
Okay.
The jewel thief told me that Bill became his cellmate. He was a sullen, difficult prisoner, and he spent a lot of his time in solitary. Bill was an ignorant boy who could hardly read or write. He'd never known what went on in the world outside his own immediate problems. One day, after he'd been in prison for about a year...
Telegram for you, Bill. Here.
Telegram?
Want me to read it to you, Bill?
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead, Slick.
It's, bad news, Bill. Your mother died this morning.
Yeah? Well, that's too bad. Gee, so Ma died.
The jewel thief told me that he'd become very much interested in Bill. The boy became stricken with remorse and began to feel that his crime had been responsible for his mother's death, and quite rightly so. In the meantime, his cellmate, the jewel thief, for lack of something better to do, because he found Bill basically intelligent, began to teach him to read and write. They used books they got from the social service agencies.
The Swiss family Robinson. Already the tempest had...
Continued.
continued 6 days. And on the seventh, it's Fury.
Well, you're certainly doing better now than you did 6 months ago. Go on.
Okay. And Tiny Tim said, God bless us, everyone. Say, this ain't... isn't a bad story, is it? Peace ho. Let us hear him. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears.
Can you imagine? 2 years ago, you could hardly read. Go on.
I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often perished.
The jewel thief told me that when he was ready to leave prison, he found that Bill's viewpoint on life had undergone a considerable change. He was no longer quite as much of a troublemaker as he had been. I thought this was a splendid story. The story of how a thief had helped with the regeneration of a murderer. I told the story on my program, Life Studies. Shortly afterwards, I got a beautifully written letter from the boy himself. He'd heard about my broadcast from one of the men on the prison farm who had listened to it. We began to write to each other. I asked him if he ever had any visitors, and he wrote me that since he'd been in prison, he hadn't had a single one. So that Christmas, I went to see him and took him some books. I write to Bill regularly and make it a point to see him every Christmas. I'm the only visitor he ever has. I'm not saying he's become an angel, Graham, since he's learned to read and write, but since he's learned another angle of life through books, he says he's convinced that he's through with crime. I do my best to keep him in contact with life by writing to him as often as I can, giving him the color of life through my eyes.
How old is he now, Tom?
About 32.
Well, is there any chance of him ever being paroled, Tom?
I don't know. But if he does get paroled, I think he'll be worthy of it.
It's a grand story. Thank you, Tom Power. Thank you.
Next week's program will be most unusual. It'll be entirely devoted to a salute to the entertainment pioneers of radio. Those gay people who amused you in the days when nobody knew if radio was here to stay. You will hear the voice of the Silver Mask Tenor once more. The music of Godfrey Ludlow. And the voice of my old radio twin, Phillips Carlin. The piano of WEAF's first accompanist, Winifred T. Barr, and many others. This is Graham McNamee saying good afternoon, all. Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis. Original music composed and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
From NBC in the 1940s, that's Behind the Mic. Now we're going to skip ahead a decade to Europe Confidential, some detective stuff here, and the Desert Gold Affair.
Presenting the world's greatest mysteries. And now, your host.
This is Basil Rathbone. Everybody loves a mystery, and I'm no exception. And that's why it gives me so much pleasure to act as your guide on this series. You see, we've gathered together some of the finest mystery stories in the world. Stories from many places and from many times. Some of them are up to date, well, as up to date as today's newspaper. Others are classic stories of the past. But today's mystery, for instance, it takes place in Europe, the Europe of modern times. A world of intrigue and suspense where a man's life can count for very little when a country's future is at stake. Mike, our storyteller, works in the Paris office of a famous American newspaper. His job is to look for the stories that make the news, and he finds them in the places where the news is made. In a moment, our play begins.
presenting Europe Confidential.
These crates are heavy, Paul.
Don't complain of their weight, old chum. Remember, the heavier they are, the richer we'll be.
In a moment, we'll bring you Lionel Merton as Mike Conoy, the Paris correspondent of a famous American newspaper, in another exciting story in our series, Europe Confidential.
This is Mike Conoy. It's my job on this news beat of mine to meet all shades of characters. The honest, the not-so-honest, and the rogues, pure and simply. I guess there wouldn't be any hesitation about it. Paul Garfield would go into that last category. For Paul Garfield made his living by his wits, and I knew that day in Beirut that he wasn't hanging around the waterfront just to catch the sea breeze. Beirut was way off Garfield's regular beat, quite a distance off mine, too. My presence there, I could explain. The explosive Middle East situation. But his explanation was much more original.
Wondering why I'm here, are you, Conoy? Well, not a word to the peace, old chum, but I'm about to uphold law and order.
Yeah, that'll be the day.
Believe me, I have the backing of at least three governments behind me.
You know, I'd just love to know which three.
I'll confide in you, Conoy, though it's against my better judgment. You may know, gold in the Orient fetches higher prices than in Europe. A shocking thing, Conoy. A great deal of gold is being smuggled east through Beirut and the Persian Gulf.
Yeah, doesn't sound honest.
A distressing practice. I was approached on a high level and told that certain European governments would look very kindly on any efforts to halt this smuggling. For instance, if the smugglers were made to realize their shipments do not occasionally get through as planned. For one who could make them realize this, the proceeds of such gold would be given to the man who makes the arrangements, if you follow me, Conoy.
Yeah, I'm trying to. You've been told to hijack some smuggled gold shipments, and if you do, the gold's yours.
Hijack? Well, hardly. This is an honest venture.
Well, how can it be done?
Simple. You see, the usual route for the smugglers is from Beirut by chartered plane to a small sheikdom on the Persian Gulf called Kuwait. Here, the gold's dumped out on the sand. No armed guards, no security, no precautions. The sheikhs in Kuwait presently have it carried a small craft, dhows, in the harbor. Aboard these dhows, the gold is hidden on the legal cargoes of dates or figs. Immense to sail east to Karachi or Goa or Macau or...
No armed guards?
Ridiculous, isn't it? The sheikhs are persuaded that their local punishment for thievery is enough of a deterrent.
Oh. And the local punishment is,
Well, my principles don't go into details on that. More important matters to discuss, you know.
Well, maybe I can give you the lowdown here. I've heard something about this local sheikh treatment. They believe in public flogging, notching of the nose, clipping off ears. Nothing really serious, of course, but...
Flogging and nose? Ears?
It's an old Mid-Eastern custom. Don't get caught, will you, Paul? You know, I don't think you'd like it a bit. Away he went, and I'd have given plenty to go along, but he wasn't trusting any newspaper man that far. So the rest of the story I had to reconstruct from what I found out later, and this is just the way it happened. It seems that after he left me, Paul Garfield met up with a couple of his chosen chums, Clancy, an Irish pilot, and Singh, a Lascar sailor, both of them very eager to earn a fast buck and not too choosy about how they went about it.
Kuwait? Sure. I've been there a dozen times. Charter flights to the airfield there.
And you, Singh, you know the wharves at Kuwait? No way you can lay your hands on a good seaworthy dhow there?
Easy.
Clancy, I understand there are certain scoundrels who smuggle gold through Kuwait.
Sure. Flight from here in Beirut, dump it on the sands, Some natives come along after a while and cart it down to the docks.
And that's just what we'll do. Now remember, both of you, from now on, I am Dr. Paul Garfield, FRCS, well-known archaeologist, right?
Whatever you say, Paul.
Same. You leave at once for Kuwait and hire a dhow. Clancy here and I will give you a head start. Then we'll fly to the airport, but we'll have to land because of engine trouble. I am an archaeologist looking for likely ruins to dig up. Clancy,
You
will not be able to fix our engine until the moment when there is a big shipment of gold lying on the sand by the airport.
This begins to sound promising.
At that point, you tell me the engine is all right again. I arrive, change inside the plane to the clothes of a native. Singh drives a cart up. He and I load the gold shipment into the cart, drive it down to the docks, dump it into the dhow, and sail 100 miles down the Gulf.
Where I meet you with a plane.
Right. And we fly on to Karachi and sell it.
Why not?
Nobody stops us.
So long as everything works just as the sheiks always do it.
Simple and sweet.
He's worth a fortune.
And a quarter share for each of you when it's sold in Karachi. Done?
Done.
The Grapevine had news of a rich, fat shipment of gold due into Beirut in a couple of days. They gave Singh a head start, then Garfield and Clancy took off for Kuwait. 5.5 hours across the deserts and mountains of the Middle East, and their plane was circling above an airfield.
There it is. Can you make the motor miss to make a landing look good and necessary?
Right.
Heat reached up and met them, swallowed them. It was infernally hot, a moist, humid heat. Clancy went away to report his engine trouble, ask for parking space, but he was back in a few minutes.
Hey, Paul! Paul!
What's the matter? They didn't swallow your story about the plane?
Oh, sure, sure, that's okay. But I was in the dispatcher's office. I saw a letter on his desk.
Yeah?
Plane due in tomorrow with a consignment for the Sheikh Sir Sulaiman Al-Hamad bin Tamur.
So what?
I know him, that's what. He's the biggest man in the gold business here in Kuwait. It must be the shipment we heard about back in Beirut, don't you see?
In tomorrow, huh? I'll have to work fast and in this heat, too. You stay here and fuss with the plane. I'll get into town, buy some native clothes, and contact Singh.
Ah, there she is. Tied up at the end of the wharf, see?
Well, they all look alike, these dons.
Ah, that's good. Harder to catch us.
Crew?
Don't worry.
Cargo of dates to hide our crates on it?
Already aboard.
You hide a cart. We'll need it tomorrow morning.
I'll be there. You just say when?
1 o'clock.
One? In the afternoon. But the heat, 130 degrees at least.
Exactly, old chum. There's people around to watch us, the better.
Garfield left the waterfront, went back to the town's best hotel, carrying his package of clothes. The town's best was a glum hostelry, with a villainous-looking clerk. Paul put over his archaeology story and handed the clerk a card printed for the occasion.
Yes, sir, Dr. Garfield. You want rooms, fine suite, running water, hot and cold, a cross ventilating, very fine suite. Sign here, please.
He leaned down, signed his name, and then straightened again, glancing over his shoulder. That was when he saw her.
Luggages, sir. You have luggages, no doubtless. Dr. Garfield, where are your luggages, sir? Just only this bundle.
That woman. Who is she, man?
Across the foyer. That is Falura. She is dancer. Dr. Garfield, your luggage.
Never mind my luggage a minute. Hello.
You asked my name, Dr. Garfield. I see your lips move.
How do you know me?
Everyone hears of the plane that is forced to land, of the famous archaeologist.
What's a girl like you doing here in a place like this, huh?
I have been waiting, perhaps, for you to come and take me away with you. No? All that was in your look a few moments ago.
You're staying here at this hotel? I'll call for you this evening.
Not this evening. This evening I am engaged, but you shall see me tomorrow.
Too late. I'll be gone.
So? Or will you wait, stay over tomorrow after all? I think you will wait for me.
She turned and walked away, and she didn't look back. He watched while she went out and down the steps and into the limousine that was waiting at the door. Oh, it was too bad. If it hadn't been for the gold that would lie waiting on the airfield beside the strip tomorrow morning. Oh, too bad. Come in.
Dr. Garfield, sir.
Oh, it's you. What do you want?
An invitation has come for you, sir. The Sheik throws a big party tonight. He has heard that you, a famous archaeologist in town, visiting. He has sent you an invitation for his big brawl. Very lucky for you, Dr. Garfield. Social event of the whole season in Kuwait.
Sheik? What Sheik?
Sheik Sir Suleiman El Hamad Bin Tamur.
Sheik Sir Suleiman...
He greatly anxious to meet you, Doctor. Talk of scientific matter.
Scientific matters?
Sheik, famous amateur archaeologist. Writes many books. Glad to talk with you, Dr. Garfield.
Dr. Paul Garfield had to send his regrets. He would like to attend the Sheik's party, but he had a splitting headache. The sun and the heat, you know, it was too bad. Next morning, he was on his way out of the hotel. 0 hour was coming up, and so was a lithe and lovely girl on the stairs.
Where do you go so early, handsome one?
Laura, I'm leaving Kuwait.
It is not possible.
I tried to tell you. Have to leave today by plane for India.
Then I go with you.
I'm afraid not.
You shall take me.
Falura, my lovely Arabian moonflower, listen to me.
Oh, the first pretty thing you have said to me. I shall treasure it.
Goodbye, Falura. You are not coming with me. I'm going alone. Goodbye.
No, wait. You mean it.
Certainly I do. I'm late now. Goodbye.
Oh, but wait. You have toyed with Falura. This is rash.
Goodbye.
Oh, say au revoir.
Goodbye. Laura may have been beautiful, but she was beginning to get in Garfield's hair. A half hour later, he was in his native clothes, working with Singh, loading a batch of crates that had been landed by plane and which lay unguarded, defenseless, and ripe for the plucking. They loaded them into the cart that Singh had brought with him, under the broiling sun, while no one stirred in the midday heat.
Oh, they're heavy, Paul.
Don't complain of their weight, old chum. Remember, the heavier they are, the richer we shall be. Anyone around?
No one. In this heat, not even a mad dog, my friend. There's certainly no Englishman.
Then into the cart with these crates.
The gods were with them. Why should anyone stop two Arabs from loading crates into a native cart? What could be more brazen and therefore seem more innocent?
Go on, you lazy devil.
Off to the airfield, with Singh laying his whip across the backs of the two plodding, sweating beasts, into the town and down toward the docks, past the hotel.
If you'd like, Paul, take a glance over at the hotel veranda. Oh, boy. Something I'd almost give my share of this gold for.
And it was Falura, of course. Garfield glanced quickly out of the corner of his eye and just as quickly glanced away again. She was standing staring at them, and for a moment it seemed as if her hand was going up in an involuntary gesture of recognition.
What's the matter?
That girl, back in the veranda. Take a look. She's still staring at us.
Are you crazy? Why should she? No, of course not. She's gone back into the hotel. Your nerves are jumping.
By mid-afternoon, they were out in the Persian Gulf, out and away and cool and utterly unsuspected. For the airport officials knew that Dr. Paul Garfield had flown off at 1 o'clock bound for India and would never guess that his plane, only 200 miles out of Kuwait, would put down, refuel, and be loaded with a heavy and priceless cargo before heading in earnest for India.
Ah, I feel better now. Almost weren't airborne back there. That's too heavy a load for safe flying, Paul.
You too, Clancy, you too.
Me too what?
Like Citizen Singh back there, you complain of the weight of our payload? $100,000 worth. That's what we'll charge for this cargo in Karachi.
Why not put down at Goa?
I heard of a Portuguese there named Parando, who buys gold.
Karachi, I said, Clancy. Karachi's the place to get the best price.
Six hours later, they landed at Karachi Airport. Everything was in order, but speed was of the essence now.
Okay, Clancy, everything clear?
Sure, Paul.
I just want to visit this dealer first, make sure he's the man for us. I should be back inside an hour. Don't let anyone near the plane.
Trust me, Paul.
I will.
He did, and that's where he made his big mistake. It took Garfield an hour to find his merchant in the city. 10 minutes to learn that he had a man who'd make a quick and profitable deal. Half an hour to get back to the airport.
You Dr. Paul Garfield?
That's right.
This note is for you.
Note? Note from whom?
From a pilot named Clancy. He left it just before he took off.
Took off?
The note made it quite clear. Clancy and Singh had decided 100% was better than 50. Paul stood there staring at the note, remembering that Clancy had wanted to fly to Goa, had mentioned the name of a dealer there. He tried to recollect the name and hardly even noticed the large passenger plane landing, the people disembarking, until a voice cut through his desperately urgent thoughts.
Dr. Garfield, Paul, my handsome one.
Hello.
I took a chance. I thought it would be Karachi where I would find you. A passenger plane was leaving soon after you, and here I am.
You're crazy.
Oh, after you had left me, I thought and I thought, handsome one. When you said goodbye, when you refused even to say au revoir, I realized, handsome one, that this was the shy, unworldly professor, embarrassed because of his poverty. So I swallowed my pride and came looking for you. And I have found you again, handsome one.
Paranda. That's it. That's the name.
What? Whose name? Where are you going, Paul? Wait! Wait!
Maybe I can use you. Allura?
Yes?
I've got to charter a plane to Goa. It's a business matter of great urgency. A fast plane. I need the fastest. Can you help me with the language?
And I will come with you.
Well, all right. If you insist, I guess...
Come. We will charter the fastest plane in all Karachi. And Kamadeva shall be our pilot.
Kamadeva?
In this land, Kamadeva is the god of love.
More than 800 miles down the west coast of India lies Goa, capital of Portuguese India. Garfield reckoned that Clancy and Singh had an hour's head start. They couldn't take less than 5 hours, and the plane he'd chartered was guaranteed to get there in four. He just had a chance. All he had to do would be to get rid of Falura, pay off the pilot, and find Paranda's offices. And just 4 hours later, he was circling above the ancient city of Goa. They landed. He raced from the landing strip to the administration building. He wanted a taxi. That was his first move, to brush Falura off and go in search of Paranda.
Taxi! Taxi!
I beg your pardon, but... aren't you Dr. Paul Garfield?
Why, yes, I...
Paul, where are you going?
Professor Garfield, is it not? The well-known archaeologist?
Yes, but I really must apologize. Taxi! I'm in a terrible hurry right now. Taxi!
I can't tell you how I've longed to meet you, Professor. You see, I dabble a bit in archaeology myself. Nothing up to your work, I must say. Your treatise on the diggings at El Amarna. A revelation, my dear sir. I am proud to meet you.
Taxi!
Perhaps you would be good enough to permit me to accompany you, Professor.
Taxi's up.
Thank you. Sorry, old chum. We'll talk about the digging some other time. Get going, quick.
Paul, don't leave me.
Professor, wait.
Did you hear me? Get going.
Yes, sir.
Paul! Paul!
Gently, boys. Gently.
Yeah, gently, boys. Gently.
Paul!
Give it. You boys have rather inconvenienced me. Please, Clancy, don't reach for your pocket. As you may notice, my hand is already in my pocket, and it isn't my pipe stem that's pointing at you, I can assure you.
What are you talking about, Paul? That little joke we had on you back at Karachi. Why, we were just...
Yes, a joke, Paul, a joke.
Well, if both of you boys are extremely cooperative, I still may let you have 10% of the proceeds to divide between you, minus my expenses in chartering a plane to catch up with you. Does that seem satisfactory, Clancy? Now, don't make me waggle this cumbersome pistol too long.
Paul, listen...
I know, we were just joking. Nevertheless, the penalty for practical jokes is severe when my profits are involved. Oh, my gosh.
You see, he's stopping them.
Yes, I think you're right, my dear. I think he is a fellow archaeologist, after all.
What?
Certainly he is, a Suleiman.
What's this, a Suleiman?
Why, I thought you knew him, handsome one. This is the Sheikh Sir Suleiman al-Hamad bin Taimur.
Delighted, Professor. I had been looking forward to a chat the other evening, except that you were suddenly taken ill, I understand.
Well, yes,
I must say I'm most grateful for all your efforts at halting these brigands. You'll forgive me, for a time I actually thought you were part of the plot to hijack my gold. As soon as you told Falura back in Karachi that the name was Piranda, he found the opportunity to ask Karachi radio operator to send me the information. I was, at the time, flying from Kuwait, and naturally I radioed ahead to my good friend Piranda. We've often done business together in the past, and he arranged to have some Goa police inside his place of business here.
Police?
Yes, they're ready to take these two thieves in charge right now, I believe.
Now, look here, Paul.
And a very good thing, too.
Oh, Paul, that did not turn out well.
You're not getting away with this, Garfield.
All right now, my men, just move along inside the shop, please. Be good enough to respect this obviously emotional moment. These two wish to be alone.
Yes, handsome one. Soon we will be alone.
Believe me, Falura, I cannot wait for that moment.
Oh, Professor, just before I go, is it possible I have confused your work in the field with that of Sir Paul Hartsfield? Your names are so familiar. Was it his treatise on the dig at El Amarna?
Well, that's very possible.
Oh, how very embarrassing.
Please, it's really of no importance. Suppose you just take care of those two scoundrels, and then maybe we can...
have a real chat about archaeological matters. Fine, fine. Oh, by the way.
Yeah?
Please accept this, a small reward for your friendly intervention.
Oh, really? It was a...
No, I insist. Here, Falura, you make him take it. Professor, you perhaps don't realize how valuable a shipment this was that you saved. I'll see you in a few moments.
We will wait, Sir Suleiman.
Falura.
Yes, handsome one. You would prefer not to wait?
To be alone with you.
I understand. Come, we will see if there is a bank open which will cash the Sheikh's check. You see, the reward is for honesty, handsome one.
Yes. Slender return on investment. Come, my moonflower. This reward for honesty can be best celebrated without the presence of the Sheikh.
Been listening to Lionel Merton as Mike Conoy in another exciting episode in the series Europe Confidential.
This is Basil Rathbone again. We've reached the end of today's story, but I'll be back to introduce to you another unusual tale. Remember, for this series, we've searched the whole world to bring you stories of every kind. Tales of espionage, suspense, crime, and intrigue. By famous writers from every part of the globe. In fact, a selection of the finest stories that have ever been assembled in one series. Well, goodbye now, till we meet again, to listen to another of the world's greatest mysteries.
Time to go, but we'll be back next week with more great old-time radio from all over the place for you here on the Radio Theater Channel's Weekly Download.